The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
This is Jackson Brown, and you're listening to the Nicole Sandler Show.
Hey, this is John from Five for Fighting, and you got my buddy, my longtime friend, the lovely Nicole Sandler.
Hi, this is Donald Fagen.
And this is Walter Becker.
You know, Steely Dan. And you're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Hey, this is Jake Slichter.
John Munson.
Dan Wilson. We are Semisonic.
And you're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Hi, this is Melissa Etheridge, and you're listening to my friend, Nicole Sandler.
Hey, how you doing out there? This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to Nicole Sandler.
Hey, everybody, this is Pat Monahan from the band Train, and you're listening to Nicole Sandler, my favorite on-air personality.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Music to my ears.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a Friday. It's a Friday here, spinning mad tunes on the big platter. I never did that kind of radio, ever. And just as we were going on the air, my audio streaming... I'm fixing it right now. My audio streaming apparatus froze, so I have to reboot it. So this is, you know, real-time engineering and talking at the same time. And who said that I can't chew gum and walk at the same time? Hopefully, we are now streaming audio again. Hey, David, is it working? Hopefully it's working. That should have done the trick, I hope. You never know around these parts. But I know there's one other thing I need to do. Bear with me. It's, yes, it's working. Okay, good. And he just tripped over one of my landmines because it's the sign of a creative mind, don't you know? Yeah, let me just do one more thing, and we should be... up and running. Okay, so here we go. The police pursuit in Miami-Dade ended 40 minutes ago. I didn't even know there was one. But I'll tell you what also ended in Florida. For this, I need to back up just a little bit. So you probably heard the news story because I did it both yesterday and today in What's News. Let me read to you from my What's News script, if I can. Because this is one, it's a related story too, by the way. Here, it starts like this. A federal judge on Thursday sentenced Dr. Simone Gold, a Beverly Hills physician who founded the anti-vaccine group America's Frontline Doctors, to 60 days in prison for illegally entering the Capitol during the January 6th attack. Yes, yeah, so, you know, she wasn't batshit crazy enough, so she also... went into the Capitol on January 6th. The judge also ordered Gold, whose group has spread debunked claims about COVID-19, to pay a $9,500 fine. That is the biggest fine levied yet for the nearly 200 rioters already sentenced. America's Frontline Doctors has done fundraising, claiming Gold was being persecuted for giving a speech before the riot. But the judge, U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper, told her during the sentencing, quote, January 6th was about a lot of things, but it wasn't about free speech or COVID vaccinations. The only reason you are here is where and when and how you chose to express your views. Boom. Well, you see... this America's Frontline Doctors is the, remember the woman, the doctor who held up whatever, and she talked about, I don't know, sex aliens or something. That's America's Frontline Doctors. You know who else is a member of that group? Florida's so-called Surgeon General. This guy, Latipo, who death sentence plucked from obscurity. I know Latipo says that he worked at UCLA Medical Center and he was there for the first wave of COVID. The people at UCLA Medical Center say, we've never heard of this guy. Don't know who he is. He didn't work with us. But, you know, that's how death sentence rolls. Or for short, just call him DeSantis because, you know, that's who he is. So, I'm looking at the newspaper, right? This is today's newspaper. Front page of the Miami Herald, right here. It says, DeSantis defends state decision not to order COVID vaccines for young kids. There are 50 states in the United States. The deadline for ordering these COVID vaccines for children 5 and under was Tuesday, in order to get them by this weekend so that our kids can start being vaccinated. This is what parents have been waiting for, right? So Florida, the only state in the union that did not order these COVID vaccines for kids five or under. And just so you know where Florida is right now, it's your number one destination in the country if you want to catch COVID. They're barely doing any testing here anymore, except for the home tests, which don't get counted in the official tally. Right? Florida reported 3 times as many cases as any other state yesterday alone, and also leads in hospitalizations and deaths per day.
We're number one, damn it!
Yeah, that's us. So every state in the union, except for Florida, had already placed an order with the federal government to ensure coronavirus vaccines for young children are delivered as soon as the regulators authorize their use. Every state except Florida. Florida missed the Tuesday deadline to request delivery of the pediatric vaccines for children under 5. All other 49 states place pre-orders, which will be delivered in 2 tranches, beginning as early as Monday, to thousands of pediatrician offices, children's hospitals, pharmacies, and health centers across the country. Those facilities in Florida will not have access during this time and will remain without supply until Florida places an order. That was in my news. That's from the news I gleaned at 6 o'clock this morning, pulling it all together. Today's Miami Herald comes on the first page, front page, right here. DeSantis defends state decision not to order COVID vaccines for young kids. Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday defended the state's decision not to pre-order COVID-19 vaccines for children under 5, saying parents who want the shots can access them without the state's help.
Bullshit.
Quote, "Our Department of Health has been very clear. The risks outweigh the benefits."
Bullshit.
"And we recommend against." He said this at a press conference in the Everglades to announce the state's annual Python Capture Challenge. Hey, that's what you can do with your COVID-infected people. Put them out to try to capture pythons in the Everglades and let nature take its course. Anyway, he continued. He said, "Doctors can get it. Hospitals can get it. But there's not going to be any state programs that are going to be trying to, you know, get COVID jabs to infants and toddlers and newborns," he said. "That's not something we think is appropriate." Did I miss something? Did DeSantis go to medical school while he was at Yale or Harvard or wherever he went? And that's not where we're going to be utilizing our resources in that regard. The article continues. Florida is the only state in the nation that does not place pre-orders. We just went through all this. The pre-ordered vaccine specifically tailored for children aged 6 months to 5 years will be delivered in 2 tranches. I got all that, right? Then above this article that continues, there's a whole other one. And this headline reads, "We are devastated. Doctors angry over DeSantis not ordering COVID vaccines for young kids." Hey, doctors, parents, everybody in Florida, remember this come November, please. And everybody else, remember this come 2024. You do not want this guy as your president, God, let alone governor. Let me read you from a little bit of this top article. Dr. Lisa Gwynn can order a COVID-19 vaccine for a Florida 7-year-old, but she can't for an immunocompromised toddler. Gwynn, a pediatrician with the University of Miami Health System and president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, is outraged over Governor DeSantis' decision not to pre-order COVID-19 vaccines for children under 5, the only state in the nation too that has not done so. His decision leaves Florida pediatricians, hospitals, and healthcare centers scrambling to obtain a supply on their own, potentially delaying vaccines for tens of thousands of children across the state. Doctor said, we are devastated. You know, this goes against all scientific recommendations. We've waited for a long time for the data to be made available, and now we know that the vaccine is safe and effective for children under five. And to have this happen without any warning, it's just unbelievable. So there's a lot of this, right? So now I get an alert from the Miami Herald. And the Miami Herald headline, this updated at 2:35 this afternoon. DeSantis reverses, allowing Florida healthcare providers to order vaccines for kids. What? But now he's saying he didn't change anything. You can't have it both ways, Ronnie. Let me read to you. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is now allowing healthcare providers, including pediatricians and children's hospitals, to order COVID-19 vaccines from a federal program for children between 6 months and 5 years old, a reversal from earlier this week when providers were prevented from pre-ordering doses, White House officials told McClatchy. It's a journalism group. The decision will expand access to pediatric coronavirus vaccines for parents across the state, which, under DeSantis's previous position, would have been limited to seeking vaccines at a select number of community health centers and facilities participating in a federal retail pharmacy program. But the DeSantis administration is pushing back aggressively. Well, of course they are, because they don't do it any other way. Aggressively against the notion that its position has changed. That's what they're pushing back in. Our position hasn't changed. They say they never planned on preventing private healthcare providers from ordering doses.
Bullshit.
But those private providers were unable to access orders before a Tuesday deadline from the Centers for Disease Control to access initial doses over the first 2 weeks of availability. It could now take up to 2 weeks for deliveries to arrive based on orders placed today. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said, we're encouraged that after repeated failures by Governor DeSantis to order COVID-19 vaccines, even after every other state had ordered them, the state of Florida is now permitting healthcare providers to order their own vaccines for our youngest children. She said, we believe it's critical to allow parents everywhere to have the choice to get their kids vaccinated and have a conversation with their pediatrician or healthcare provider. And then she said, even though Governor DeSantis reversed course and is now ordering vaccines, we will pull out every lever to get pediatricians across Florida vaccines as quickly as possible. So now the administration has to scramble so that Florida can get some shots for when they start. This man is an abomination. He is a miserable, ugly, inside and out, sorry excuse for a human being. He's got two little kids, probably both under five. How much you want to bet they're already vaccinated? God, this so pisses me off. Okay, so... Hi, welcome to a Friday. So today, no hearing today. We covered yesterday's hearing. And frankly, I'm a bit hearinged out because everybody else is doing it. So I thought today we're going to do something completely different. And it's Friday. And on Friday, well, the weekend, you know, some of us like to let loose, kick back, relax. I'm not a beer drinker. Never. Ugh. Just don't like the taste of it. Never, ever drank beer. I mean, I've tasted it, but never drank more than a sip at a time in my whole life and said, no, not for me. Now, I do enjoy the occasional wine, but honestly, wine and other alcohol aggravates my restless leg syndrome. And you know that's really bad. So my drug of choice has always been marijuana. Yes, David?
Check your email. I just sent you, there's an article from the Tampa Bay Times talking about our fearless leader.
Rona Ronnie?
Yes.
Okay.
Who is playing with gas taxes to aid in his reelection.
Oh, my God.
And there is a great line in it wherein the writer of the article says that Rona Ronnie thinks that his constituents are dumber than a sack full of Matt Gaetzes.
Oh, I saw that line. I did see. I saw this story. See, every week, actually, it's almost every day, there's something else with Mr. of Satan. And now I need to start assembling a list, and I will in my spare time. If anyone wants to start the list for me, please, you know, please do. So here's the deal. All right. Let me read to you. I'm just going to read this. It's a guest columnist, Daniel Ruth, has his own spirited answer to this important question. Did politics influence the timing of Florida's 25-cent gas holiday? Oh, we have a 25-cent gas holiday? Oh, he's trying to buy off Floridians. This guy writes, how low will Florida Governor Ron DeSantis go to abuse his power in pursuit of not only his reelection, but his delusional ambitions to become the craven heir to the traitor and thief of Mar-a-Lago? I like the way this guy writes already. Oh, this fabulous limbo bar knows no depth of deceit. Picking fights with mask-wearing high school students. Yeah, he did that. Wait, I should tick off the things. What else? Punishing Disney World for committing free speech, cooking the COVID books, and saving the best or worst for last, threatening to fine the Special Olympics $27.5 million for simply requiring 5,500 participants in the games, many with pre-existing medical conditions, to be vaccinated against COVID. Let's reflect on that one more time. Florida's governor threatened to imperil the Special Olympics, a beloved institution that has only sought to do good things for disabled children. This cannot stand. Can you get any sleazier than that? Well, DeSantis is always up for a challenge. What's next? Attacking the Girl Scout cookies for selling dark chocolate tagalongs because they secretly represent critical race theory. Oh, oops. Almost hit the wrong button. Well, I did. Critical race theory. Wait, come on. You know he's thinking about it. But wait, the Vladimir Putin of the Appalachian Parkway still wasn't done. The Florida legislature approved a 25-cent reduction in the state gas tax. It's not much, but it was better than nothing. And given the rising costs impacting every Floridian, it shouldn't have been that big a deal to implement the gas tax break immediately. How hard would this have been? What? He even had to ask? Alas, dear reader, this is Tallahassee, after all. It seems a factotum on the governor's crack staff suggested it might be a swell idea to delay the 25-cent tax break until October, oh my God, which by amazing coincidence is the month before the November election. Phew, no political mischief at work, nothing to see here. Of course, the governor could have said, not on my watch, I'm not going to use the fine people of Florida as mere political pawns to advance my electoral prospects. Yeah, right. Instead, he went along with the scam, which only proves we all have a price. It's only a matter of negotiation. And Ron DeSantis can be had at 25 cents. Such a deal. When Lawrence Mower of the Times Herald Tallahassee Bureau exposed the 25-cent gas tax relief screw-up, Republicans went into full hummina mode, claiming that nothing was amiss here. Just like, doctors could always order the vaccines. Yeah. With a straight face, the argument went this way. The tax cut was delayed until October because that's when fewer tourists visit the state. So only loyal, hardworking Florida residents would benefit from the tax breaks.
Bullshit.
Show of hands, does anyone believe that? No. And no, Mrs. DeSantis, your vote doesn't count. Indeed, there's no evidence that there's a discernible drop off in tourism across Florida, especially not in October because that's when tourist season begins. Oh, sorry. Visit Florida, which tabulates tourism data for the state, has no numbers to back up this October claim because it's the other way. Gee, do you think DeSantis and the Republican-controlled legislature might have been fibbing? Just an idle thought. What is irrefutable is that November follows October. But given DeSantis and the state of the the state Republican Party enough time, and they'll probably figure out a way to scramble the calendar to stick June in the middle of Halloween and Thanksgiving, and why not? The DeSantis crowd already wants you to think slavery was a mere misunderstanding. You can probably rest assured by the time we start closing in on November, the DeSantis campaign will be flooding the airwaves, touting the governor's grand and glorious beneficence in easing the miserable lives of his constituents by 25 cents a gallon. You're too kind, sir. We don't deserve such compassion. We grovel in humiliation before your graciousness. Will the governor get away with the 25-cent three-card Monte con he's pulling off on the people of Florida? Maybe so. DeSantis is assuming the people of Florida are stupid, that they are dumber than a sack of Matt Gaetz's. It's not entirely a bad bet. No, it isn't. Cynical, yes. But in DeSantis' world, the people can't be hurt by what they don't know. The chances are pretty good that most of the DeSantis voters aren't even aware that the governor played them for chumps. As much as I try to tell them every day, they're not aware. After all, there are many more important issues to demand their time and attention, like Hunter Biden's laptop and the fact that Hillary Clinton still isn't in jail. For in Tallahassee, truth is a rare commodity, barely surviving on fumes. You're right. That was a great piece. Oh, my God. Yeah, it is. There's a reason I call it Florida. And let me say one other thing before I'm actually going to play a song because I need a little palate cleanser before our guests come in a few minutes. So Florida. Yeah. Wait a minute. So they talked about the I just lost my train of thought entirely. So it's not only in Florida. It's the entire Republican Party.
This is repeating.
What is?
It's repeating what you said a few minutes ago.
Oh, why does this keeps flipping over to Winamp for some reason? Okay. That should not repeat now. Okay. I don't know why it keeps doing that. That's weird. Weird. All right, so it should be good. All right, so as I was saying before I so rudely interrupted myself, so DeSantis, has all these weird theories. And, in Florida, he has the Anti-Woke Act. And that basically means, I think his no critical race theory falls under that heading. Well, first of all, no schools that aren't graduate level universities are teaching critical race theory. They're just not. It's not the curriculum. But DeSantis and his ilk seem to consider anything at all that is that teaches about American history when it comes to slavery or Jim Crow or Reconstruction or race relations or frankly institutional racism, all of that they consider to be critical race theory, and for them they think that's a dirty word. Well, let me ask you something. Sunday, June 19th, Juneteenth is now a legal federal holiday in the United States of America. It's about time. Juneteenth was the day that the last group of slaves, of human beings, still held as slaves, even though they'd already been freed, but they didn't know it because the Emancipation Proclamation never made it to them, I believe, in Texas. So they were kept as property under slavery until they finally got word that they had indeed been emancipated, that slavery was over, and that's what Juneteenth is about. And just last year, it became a federal holiday. So, now school's out now. I guess, good thing, because how would teachers teach about it? How would they teach about it if all those people, I'll call them the Karens, if all of those Republican Karens said, it's critical race theory, it's critical race theory. Well, I got a song for you. This time it's a real song. It's not a parody song. It's not a joke song. This is a brand new song. Now, you may recall, if you've been listening to the show for any amount of time, couple of months ago, right around, I think it was November or December, actually, so it was more than a couple of months ago. Wow. Ben Harper was on this program. Now, I knew Ben Harper from my music radio days in Los Angeles, but we hadn't spoken in probably 20 years. But his producer, Sheldon Gomberg, is a friend of mine. And Ben was in the studio working, having Sheldon produce his new record. The new album is going to be out on July 22nd, I believe. July 22nd. And the album is to be titled Bloodline Maintenance. Bloodline Maintenance. And the first single is just out. He actually, Ben performed it on Jimmy Kimmel's show one night this week. And it's just so good. And I asked Sheldon, is there any way you can send me an advanced copy? I understand the only thing they've released so far is this single. It's called We Need to Talk About It. He said, you got to promise you can't play anything except the single for now. No worries. I'm just excited to be able to hear good new music. So without any further ado, this is, I don't know if it's a radio premiere. I'll say it is because, no, I won't because I'm not a liar. This is the first time heard on this air, and hopefully I don't get copyright violated for it. But I think it's that important because remember, Monday is the legal holiday for Juneteenth, and fuck your rules against CRT. This has nothing to do with critical race theory. It's American history. This is Ben Harper's new song. It's called We Need to Talk About It.
I say black lives matter, 'cause history says we don't. You're either a Christian or a racist, you can't be both. Slavery, we need to talk about it.
We need to talk about it.
What does it say about America? What does it say about Africa? And what does it
say
about all of us?
All of us.
Whoever said time heals our wounds wasn't a slave.
I'm guessing.
Hundreds of years. That's just too long of a lesson.
We need to talk about it.
What does it say about the fire? And what does it say about the cellar?
Ben Harper, we need to talk about it. The album, Bloodline Maintenance, will be out on July 22nd. All right, a quick word from our sponsor, and then back, hopefully, with our guests. Here we go. Father's Day is coming up June 19th. A great gift for the doggy daddy in your life is a custom portrait of his fur baby. I'll work with you to create a keepsake painting that you can surprise him with, or you can give him a special gift certificate that allows him the experience of collaborating with me on his pet's portrait. I'm Nicole Sandler, and painting is my pandemic silver lining. And it's not just pet portraits anymore. So maybe you want to support my show by buying some of my art, but you don't really have a pet to paint? That's okay. There's lots of other stuff. There's a whole category of boxes, wall hangings, and other things. We've got cabinets and coat racks and boxes galore. Lots of different gift ideas, and they're not just for Father's Day either. So check out paintyourpets.net. That's paintyourpets.net. Still don't see just what you're looking for? Well, contact me anyway. Tell me what you want, and we'll see what we can do. paintyourpets.net. A gift for the animal lovers in your life, visit paintyourpets.net for more information. All right, thanks for putting up with my little commercial, and they're not just for Father's Day either. All right, so I do see we have a guest in the room, but it seems like he can't hear. You know what, I'm just going to bring him in because, you know, we're informal around here. Hi, I'm guessing this is Robin Goldstein with me. Is that you? Robin, can you hear me?
That's me. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. You were motioning like you couldn't hear or something. Was there a problem?
Nope. Just trying to make it work.
Well, it's working. Good. So is Daniel joining us or is it just you and me?
I believe he's joining us, but maybe he's having some problems, but we can start.
Okay. We've started. So I'll keep an eye out for him. And when he shows up, I'll bring him in. So Robin Goldstein, along with Daniel Sumner, wrote a new book. It's called Can Legal Weed Win? The Blunt Realities of Cannabis Economics. I see what you did there. You know, at first, when I first got the book, I'm thinking, these guys don't know what they're talking about. Because I'm here in Florida, where we do have medical marijuana, and they're making a killing. So obviously, they're doing okay. But as I read a little bit more, I got the gist of what you were saying. They are making a killing despite themselves, it seems, because to get a card to be able to buy medical marijuana here in Florida, you've got to jump through a million hoops and you got to pay a lot of money. And it's so backwards. I don't know if you know the specifics of Florida, but they just instituted a new policy that you can only get as much legal weed each month as you purchased in the past 3 or 4 weeks. I don't know what the metrics are, but basically it makes you keep buying more and more, because if you don't, when you want more, you're not going to be able to get it because they will cut your allotment at what you got in the last time period. Does that make sense?
Not at all.
No, not at all.
And I haven't heard about that specific system, but you've got a patchwork of weird rules and weird laws all over the country. Every state's doing it differently. No one's figured it out. That's part of what we say in the book. And, you know, Florida's in this one of the states that's medical only. Unlike Florida, California had a very liberal system for who could get into the medical, who could get a medical permission. You could just Skype with some doctor for 5 minutes, send him $30 with your credit card and have a medical card. Totally different from Florida. That was the system that was in place until 2017. Then 2018 came along. California legalized adult use or recreational, meaning that anyone could buy it.
Right.
But weirdly, what happened when that system started was that it actually made it more difficult, not easier, to buy weed. And more than anything, it made it more expensive because they instituted a lot of new regulations and taxes that actually made the system more complicated, not less. So, you know, a lot of activists and people who are trying to get into the industry are hoping for this sudden watershed of legalizing it all. And sometimes that ends up causing more problems than it solves. So no one's figured it out. That's the short answer.
No, obviously not. And again, as you said, it's like a patchwork quilt. Depending on what state you are in, they have different regulations. And they're often, well, like they are here in Florida, asinine. And, you know, it is, and it's expensive. First, you have to go to a doctor to get the prescription to get your legal weed, right? Then you have to... you get the card and they renew it. It's something, it's like every 8 months or something. So it's not even just logical. There are just random things. And each time you renew the card, costs you another couple of $100. Plus you got to pay the doctor another couple of $100. And then you go to the dispensary who, you know, it has this prescription, says, well, you're only allowed to have this much because last month you only ordered this much. So it's impossible to keep track of, when the bottom line is that the product might be good that you get from the dispensaries, but it's so expensive and so cumbersome to get to that you could still call the guy you used to buy the illegal weed from and get it for about half the price that you pay the dispensaries, right?
Yeah, that's the fundamental problem right there. You just named it, which is that people have been getting their weed. They've known how to get their weed and who to get it from. They know where to get the good stuff and what they like. They trust, you know, their dealer. Anyone who's wanted to smoke weed, whether it's Florida or any other state in America, they've been able to get it for years. And what's going to convince people to switch? You've been getting the stuff you like from a guy you like. And suddenly you're going to spend twice as much to move to get it at a legal store, or a legal delivery service that's paying all their taxes and following all these rules. What's going to make you switch? Is the weed going to be better? No. All the evidence shows that when you take it out of the package and you actually consume it, smoke it, vape it, whatever, people can't tell the difference between something that's been licensed by the state and something that hasn't.
Right.
And so these two products are competing side by side, legal weed and illegal weed. And this is the reason we call our book, Can Legal Weed Win? Is the fundamental question is, can legal weed win against illegal weed? Illegal weed doesn't suddenly go away when you create a legal system. When you add a bunch of regulations and taxes, legal weed competes side by side with illegal weed that isn't paying regulations, following regulations and paying taxes. And people need a good reason to switch. And so far as we can tell, in many states, you know, 3/4 of the weed is still illegal because
wow.
Most consumers don't find it worth spending twice as much for the legal stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason for it. It sounds like states are getting just really greedy. And the owners are. Look, when it started here in Florida, yes, hold on. My husband wants to chime in because he likes this topic too.
I happen to have a medical marijuana card.
He does.
And consume it regularly. One of the things that I would say, and let me say that I hate the state government of Florida, and just government in general, but nonetheless, I never bought anything from my friendly neighborhood weed dealer resembling CBD tinctures, which
right?
Help me every day because I have significant pain in basically my entire body.
Yep.
And no gummies. If you ever had the opportunity to find somebody who made brownies, you might get a brownie that would make you see God, and the next brownie you ate, you wouldn't see anything.
Right. So there's consistency in the products that you can get from a legal... Look, I'd rather... And you know, I like the vape cartridges because they're handy. And, you know, I'd rather not smoke something that you have to light on fire. I'm a lung cancer survivor. So I do use the vape cartridges. And frankly, I worry about the black market ones because I know some of them are laced with crap. So I like the idea that there is some regulation behind it, that I know these products are going to be safe. And I don't even mind paying a few extra bucks for them. But this is ridiculous, the hoops you have to jump through. And maybe that's because it's still only medical here in Florida. And maybe if it was adult recreational use, it wouldn't be so cumbersome. And then maybe I wouldn't mind spending a couple extra bucks. But that's not where we are. That's not what you're talking about here, is it, Robin?
Well, no, actually, it's interesting because the medical and the recreational are, it's not such a black and white thing. So it's not like you go from medical to recreational and suddenly gets better or cheaper.
Right.
On the contrary, one of the states that has the cheapest and most widely available legal weed that competes successfully with the illegal stuff is Oklahoma. And Oklahoma what? Only has medical, like Florida. Uh-huh. But unlike Florida, in Oklahoma, it's really easy to get your medical license, and it's also really easy to get your license to open and run a business.
Really? Wow.
One of the examples we like to talk about that we mentioned in the book is that, there's such a big difference between states, and when they, you know, a state passes a law, the voters pass a ballot question or the legislature passes a law that legalize weed in theory. And then what, you know, from that point to getting it actually legalized is this process of the state having to drop a bunch of regulations and create a system for stores to open and sell it legally. Mm-hmm. And so in Vermont, for example, they passed a law 4 years ago saying let's legalize. And then 4 years later, there's still not a single a legal store open where you can buy weed legally. Oklahoma passed a law and the first legal weed stores opened 9 hours later, the next morning. So there's, you know, it's funny because there's a lot of people who are against legal weed in Oklahoma, but once, you know, Oklahoma is kind of a pro-business state. And once they decided to legalize something, they're like, we like business. Let's make businesses work here. So they made it as easy to get practically as a hunting or fishing license.
But
open
you can't
a
get
store.
An abortion there. In fact, if you get pregnant, abortions are illegal from the moment of conception. So I guess you need to be stoned all the time to get by. I don't know.
There you go. I mean, it's funny because there's so many inconsistencies between, you know, the values that are embodied in states' laws. And it's just such a weird patchwork. And California, which had been serving the, you know, illegal needs of half of America, producing more illegal weed than anyone anywhere, everyone figured, oh, California legalizes, they're going to be the national leader in this industry, right? Wrong. We made it so cumbersome to get the license, and the waiting period, importantly, takes so long that you have many fewer licensed producers and licensed dispensaries or retailers than you did before when you just had the old medical system.
Right.
Another issue that's an issue in many different states is what they call local control or local option, which is to say they legalize it, but then they say every county or every local city has the right to say, okay, we voted to legalize, but not in my backyard. So
right.
you can't open a store in my town. You can't grow it here. And so in those towns and cities and counties, you have an entirely illegal market, even though the state has theoretically legalized. And so this happened in California, about 70% of the land area, but geographically voted to illegalize locally, even though they previously had all these legal medical producers before quote unquote legalization. So we say legalization, full adult use legalization, was actually more like illegalization in many, many parts of California. And that's been true in other states too.
Wow. I want to get into why and how you wrote this book. So you, Robin Goldstein, you're an economist. You are the author of The Wine Trials. So I love this because I'm not a big wine drinker, but my husband was a collector. And this was about an expose of what I call the wine snobs. And tell us about this. So you outed people who were packaging, putting cheap wine as expensive wine? Is that what that was?
Well, the idea behind the wine trials was just, you know, you buy all this wine for $100 a bottle and you buy wine at the supermarket for $5 or $10 a bottle.
Yep.
And everyone just assumes, oh yeah, you want to have celebrate a special occasion, spend a lot more money on an expensive bottle of wine and it's going to be much better wine, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out, so wine and wine critics would only even take seriously the wine that was at least $20 or $30 a bottle.
Right.
So the idea here was like, let's rate all the supermarket. Initially, the idea was just like, let's figure out which these $5 or $10 or $15 supermarket wines that were as good or better than the expensive wines that wine critics like to talk about. So I did a big, I organized a big blind tasting, like 6,000 glasses. We did it in a bunch of different cities around the country. And instead of mostly pulling wine critics, we just had everyday wine drinkers, just people with no special training, taste the wines in from brown paper, you know, bottles in brown paper bags. They didn't know what they were drinking, and say, how much do you like it? Love it. Like it. Okay. Don't like it. Hate it. And we tabulate all the results. And the weird thing was, it wasn't just that a bunch of cheap wines beat some of the expensive wines. It was that on average, people actually preferred the cheaper wines or to the expensive wines overall. And even we had a few wine experts in the group, and even they didn't significantly prefer the expensive wines to the cheaper wines. And so that pissed off a lot of people in the wine world. And we made a book out of it called The Wine Trials, which was like sort of talking about the wines that did the best in the blind tastings. Ended up doing a few different editions of it. And that's kind of what got me into economics. I was interested in, you know, you know, why are people willing to pay more for this stuff, even though it's not better?
Right. Well, that we've lived that because, well, here, David's back again.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to monopolize the conversation, but now you're really speaking.
This, now you're in his world.
I've been drinking wine since 1992, and I've really gotten turned off because it has become so much of a dick waving contest. I used to go most weekends. This time I would be at a wine store locally where we would have what's called
brown bag
happy hour on Friday.
Well, but brown bag on Saturday.
Everybody would just bring a bottle of wine to share. Then Saturday would be brown bag. And, you know, exactly what it says, brown wine in a brown bag. You try it and you try and guess what it is. And people, particularly on brown bag, they would say, oh, this is this and this is this. And, but do you like it? Oh, yeah, I like it. And then you show them it's a $20 bottle of wine, and it's like, oh.
And all of a sudden they turn their nose up.
And then another thing, it's like, oh, I taste this or I taste that. It's like, and then somebody pulls out the bottle, and it's a $200 wine. Oh, that's magnificent.
It's all about that. It's
bullshit.
Horrible.
It's just fucking bullshit. And it's turned me off to the point where I haven't been there since COVID. And yet I still enjoy the wine that I like, but I just, and my son recently, he's been working at a wine shop for like 7 years. He recently stopped working there, and that's a big part of why he stopped working there. By the way, he lives in Arizona where weed is legal recreationally, and the weed there is 25% cheaper than what we pay here.
Go figure. So, anyway, there's that. No, I was going to say, we'd go to the brown bag, and I would, you know, I'm not the wine connoisseur, but I would watch people react, because David, like you, he should probably check out the wine trials, because he would always try to find an inexpensive bottle of wine that was every bit as good as the $200 bottle, thinking people are going to love it, and then when they take it out of the bag, they're like, oh, that's what that was? Snobs. They're all snobs. So I like the weed world better. But I guess there are weed snobs too, aren't there? They can
oh yeah, there's there's an evolving world of weed snobbery. Oh, and it's only getting started. You know, the more we, you know, you legalize this stuff and you create this kind of higher end market, you know, you make legal weed so expensive and then people are like, oh, well, it's so expensive anyway, we might as well, you know, you're charging these high prices, so let's make it elite and let's talk about it the way we talk about wine. And so you have this sort of race to talk about who has the highest THC or whether it's sativa or indica. And what's interesting is there's very little scientific evidence that that these measurements really are correlated with anything that people can taste or smell or feel when you actually smoke the weed. You know, I don't know if I'll ever do the weed trials. That's certainly not with University of California funding, we won't.
Okay, so you are with the University of California at Davis. You are the director of the Cannabis Economics Group in the Department of Agricultural Resource Economics at UC Davis. So you come at it from that. Now, Daniel, who is your co-author, who's missing in action, Daniel Sumner, is Distinguished Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Davis. So do you guys work together?
Yeah, for the last 6 or 7 years, we've been working together on weed economics. So that's been my entire focus and one of Dan's projects. And we've been we actually have been working, among other things, with the Bureau of what started off is called the Bureau of Cannabis Control in California, now called the Department of Cannabis Control. That's the regulatory agency in California that runs the licensing and regulates the weed industry. One of the things we've learned is interesting. You know, we talk about all these problems with the way that it was implemented and the fact that legal weed has to be so much more expensive than illegal weed. Mostly that's not the fault of the regulators. That's not in the control of the regulators. That's the way the law was written or the way the ballot question was written. And so they're just, you know, there's a lot of, you know, well-intentioned state regulators who are just trying to make the system work. And we've been trying to help them understand the costs and the implications of the regulations that they're writing, but their hands are tied on many issues with the way the laws were originally put in, that were originally put into place. But it's been interesting coming from that angle, because we've had access to interesting data sets and from California. And we started working with them since before the recreational legalization happened. Uh-huh. And so we started in the old medical system. So we've been kind of tracking the industry. We've been like, for example, surveying millions of prices from online weed retailers and trying to understand the way the prices have been changing over time and stuff like that. So yeah, it's an interesting, cool corner of economics. You know, you have the only kind of parallel maybe is like, you know, you come out of prohibition in the 1930s right. in America where alcohol was illegal for 13 years and suddenly you make it legal. And everyone says, oh, it's just going to go legal again, right? No, people didn't suddenly stop producing moonshine. It's just suddenly you have legal and illegal markets competing. But what's interesting right now is that you're actually able to look at prices and how they're changing over time, because there's so much information in the modern world. So it's a fun thing for a project for economists.
I'll bet. And the whole thing about, you know, because marijuana, cannabis, is still listed as a Schedule I narcotic, which is ridiculous, it's still illegal on a federal level. States are legalizing it, but federally it's still illegal. And therefore, you know, there's problems with the banking industry and the marijuana industry, right? I know some places are taking some cards, but I think they're a special, like Canna Cash, or they have like special credit cards that you can use to do this. They've had to create a whole separate monetary system sort of to deal with marijuana because of the federal law against it. Is that right? Or do I have it wrong?
Yeah. So for years, I mean, and it's been getting slowly better. There's, you know, some banks in most states now that are willing to serve cannabis companies. They're not able to be FDIC insured, right, because, right. you know, it's anything related to federal government. It's illegal, as you say. But for years, they were just doing business with suitcases of cash. I mean, one of the things about this is, like, when you're dealing with suitcases of cash and storerooms full of, you know, $100 bills, you know, you have to develop a skill set. You're you know, you've got guys with guns protecting your facility and stuff. Dealing with that kind of thing is not exactly the skill set that you need to get into a legal industry and start dealing with the banking. So there's all these transition problems of people who had developed great skills and working with that old system, and suddenly you make it legal. They're not necessarily the same people who are great at going out and making a deal with the city council and making nice with their local bankers,
right?
Who they've basically been doing nothing but trying to stay off the radar screen for years. When it does get descheduled, and descheduled meaning legalized essentially federally, or decriminalized, let's say, just if you just take it off the list of Schedule I narcotics, it would make it a lot easier to do banking. And then there's IRS rules that are basically right now preventing cannabis companies from deducting a lot of normal business expenses. And so they're having to pay more taxes than a normal business would. So that stuff would get better. We also say in the book, though, and part of the problem about can legal weed win is like that when it gets federally legalized, there'll be some winners and some losers, because once you have competition between states, you can import it from any other state. Actually, not all states are going to win. Some states are able to produce it more cheaply, and some states that are where it's really expensive to run a business or to grow weed, or electricity costs are high, water costs are high, labor costs are high. Those states are going to have a hard time competing with other states in producing cheaply. And actually, Florida might have some advantages in this way, because they've got some relatively low a lower cost of doing business. California is probably not going to fare so well. In spite of its great climate for growing weed, we have really high costs of doing business and things like electricity and water. So it's going to be kind of a free-for-all. Once you legalize federally, it's going to be easier in some ways, but harder for some businesses that have figured out how to do a business well in this like a captive audience of their own state, and then suddenly they have to compete nationally.
But is there any indication that the federal laws are going to ease up, or where nothing's going to happen until they change the schedule, the narcotics, the take it off as a Schedule One narcotic?
Yeah, well, taking it off as a Schedule One narcotic is sort of step one. That may or may not happen at the same time as setting up a bunch of additional federal taxes and regulations. Actually, one of the worst things that could happen to weed with federal legalization is if the federal government decides to impose a whole other layer of taxes and regulations on top of what the states are already making people do. That's just going to make it even harder for legal weed to compete with illegal weed. And no one knows, you know, we're not in the business, Dan and I are not in the business of competing, of predicting political outcomes, but I think it'll probably happen in the next 5 years that maybe sooner that it'll be descheduled. But what form it's going to take when it's sort of more legalized federally, once you can trade between states, how much is the federal government going to intervene and say, like with alcohol, you have to get a federal license to do it anywhere, or you have to pay a federal excise tax on top of what you're paying locally? We have no idea, but it's going to be a really important question in terms of how legal weed fares all over the country.
And that has been the problem all along, is that all of these governmental fees and costs and taxes and bureaucratic stuff is the reason why the prices are so high for legal weed, and the black market stuff doesn't have those constraints. They don't have those issues. Let me tell you a story. When they were starting to license up here in Florida to get, you know, dispensaries ready to go before we had medical marijuana here, I have a friend who, she and her husband, they had a farm. He grew organic vegetables and supplied a lot of restaurants in the Tampa Bay area. Beautiful, really high quality, all organic. And they put together a presentation to get one of these 10 licenses, the first 10 licenses that they were going to give out in Florida. And they submitted their stuff. They were far and away better than most of the others that had also put their paperwork in, because of the fact that he already had this organic farm ready to go. It was organic. It set him apart from the others in that sense. And he was already doing food stuff, so ingestible things. Their application was perfect, but it got kicked back. It got first, you know, they were able to see how each of these applications was scored. And in the first round, they were right up there. But in the second round, some shenanigans, Florida politics got in the way, and they were kicked out. And some other person, some other group with nowhere near their credentials or experience got their slot. So they fought it in court, and they put every dime they had into this. I mean, they mortgaged themselves to the hilt because they already had so much at stake. And finally, Florida then added like three more licenses. So they got one. They got one of the original 13.
Yeah.
Well, within what, 2 months, they were looking for locations and things. They were bought out. Now, the company they sold to didn't have to jump through anything. They could sell to anybody. So they made a killing. They got out. They're not in the business. And she tells me it's a good thing, too, because these businesses are not set up to be mom and pops. These are big, like, corporate entities. These are big money, corporations coming in and running these companies. And they're buying up the little guys. Do you see that, too?
Yeah, that's a great example, Nicole, just because, you know, one of the worst things you can do when setting up a regulatory system, whatever the goals are you are aiming to achieve, is to set quotas. You have to, you can only allow 10 licenses, 5 licenses, 15 in a certain geographical area. That's just a recipe for corruption. It's a recipe for unfair competition. And for just situations like you described, and you've got some examples like that in different pockets of America with weed. You know, the city of Oakland, for example, said, oh, we're only going to allow 10 dispensaries in the city. And then, the competition is who gets them is depending on who you know and political cronyism and stuff. So of all the bad ways you can set up regulations, I think quotas are one of the worst.
Right. We're doing it the worst way possible, which also makes the economics of it not work. David's back. Yes.
You mentioned shenanigans. How about the amendment that was passed to allow legal weed and the court struck it down because in a couple of parts of the document, instead of it saying and, it said therefore. It was struck down on the tiniest of technicalities, despite the fact that the people of Florida wanted it. Also, I needed to ask your guest, do you watch South Park?
I've watched some South Park.
In the last couple of seasons, it's all about, they have weed farms. There's like the weed wars, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, Colorado
and one
is...
One of the fathers of one of the kids has started growing weed, and then the people across the way from them, who's their child's also a friend of his, they started growing weed. And now they've gotten into water issues, and it's a whole thing.
That's what they're dealing with on South Park these days, because Colorado, weed is a big deal, right? That was the first state to legalize recreation.
Colorado and Washington were the first two, and Colorado... I think opened stores before anyone else for recreational. So California was the first to legalize medical, but Colorado came in first recreationally. And they've now got Colorado and Washington being the first states to legalize recreational. They've got the lowest lowest legal weed prices in the country, retail prices. And so they're actually able to compete better with illegal weed than most other states, partly just because they've had more time to adjust to the system. And, you know, people have gotten to scale. People, and over time, also the rulemakers have been able to adjust things that they saw weren't working. So one kind of light at the end of the tunnel or bright spot you can look at is the longer states have, the longer governments have and operators have with this stuff, the better things get. And we're hopeful that over time around America, people will come to their senses and see what works and what doesn't work, learn lessons from states where it's working better, and adjust the systems to help legal weed win.
Well, I hope so, because I think when you're ingesting a product like this, especially one that gets you high, I like government regulations. I want to know that the product's inspected and that it's safe and it's not laced with some shit from China. I want to know that, and I don't mind paying a few extra dollars for it. I do mind paying twice the amount for it and being made to go to a doctor and then get a card and renew it every 8 months. And, you know, that's ridiculous already. Yeah. I don't drink. Well, you can have my alcohol license. Just give me the weed.
Yeah. And you should be able to get it in your own neighborhood or your own county, not have to order from or drive to some other region that hasn't banned it locally. So
that was very true.
All those things, I think over time, we're hopeful all those things will get better. But, in our book, we talk about sort of success stories and failure stories and lessons we can learn from some of the states that have learned the hard way. And some of the states have had longer to work on it.
Gotcha. The book is Can Legal Weed Win? The Blunt Realities of Cannabis Economics. Robin Goldstein, thank you. Please send our thanks to Daniel Sumner. We're sorry we missed him. And it was nice meeting you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Nicole. It's been fun.
You take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right. And with that, we're done. That's it for not only the day, but the week. This has been one hell of a week, huh? And I got to go finish up doing the broadcast. So I'll leave you with the news. I will see you Monday. Monday, which is, it is Juneteenth. It's a legal holiday. I'll be here in one form or another. I'll be here. All right. I'll see you then. Thanks for listening, everyone. Leave you with the news. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Breaking news overnight, the Washington Post reporting that Ginny Thomas, the wife of a sitting Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, was even more closely involved with the January 6th plotting than previously believed.
Whoops, this is yesterday's. That's yesterday's news. I don't like giving you yesterday's news. I need to give you today's news, right? Sorry about that. So can I find today's news? Here it is. It's always something. It's not one thing, it's another. Here we go.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
During Thursday's third day of testimony before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol, we heard live testimony from Greg Jacob. He was a legal advisor to former Vice President Mike Pence. And we also heard from top-tier conservative retired federal judge J. Michael Luttig. Let me add quickly that on Monday, we also got proof that the whole ruse of a stolen election and the Stop the Steal nonsense was sitting on ice for 4 years waiting to be resurrected. Trump knew full well that he legitimately lost the election, but continued to declare victory and accused the Democrats of stealing the win. Well, on Thursday, the former counsel to the vice president, Greg Jacob, testified that aides to the then president told him repeatedly it would not be legal for Pence to overturn President Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election. But Trump and his allies pushed for him to do it anyway. Judge Luttig, who advised Pence about his January 6th duties, said that if the vice president had done what Trump demanded, he would have sparked a revolution within a constitutional crisis. So, with that, the fourth day of hearings begins Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. One of the witnesses we're hoping to see before they wrap is Ginny Thomas. She is the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Committee Chair Benny Thompson said the panel would invite her to testify about her efforts to overturn the election. On January 6, 2021, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's wife and his best friend, Ginny, cheered on the protesters on Facebook. Earlier this year, Thomas admitted that she actually attended the January 6th rally at the Ellipse, but said she left before Trump spoke. Sure. Just over a week after that, we learned that Thomas exchanged text messages with the former president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, urging him to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. Oh, my God. In May, the Washington Post reported that Ginny Thomas pressed at least two lawmakers in Arizona to reverse Trump's loss. A month later, the Washington Post learned she actually pressed 29 Arizona lawmakers, not just two, 29. On Wednesday, the Post reported that Thomas also corresponded with lawyer John Eastman. He played a key role in the effort to pressure Pence to block the certification of Biden's win. This provoked the House committee to request Thomas's testimony, which she appears to be very open to. She told the Daily Caller she would, yet she hasn't responded directly to the commission as of yet.
Guns in the news.
Well, you couldn't go through a day without guns in the news. The lead Republican negotiator in the Senate, working with a bipartisan group of 19 other senators to draft a bipartisan gun safety bill, walked out of the talks. Yeah, John Cornyn just left, while the lead Democrat, Chris Murphy, remained optimistic that lawmakers could vote on legislation before leaving for a two-week July 4th recess. But John Cornyn appears to have already left. Just saying. And finally, you know you want to know this. A federal judge on Thursday sentenced Dr. Simone Gold. She's a Beverly Hills physician who founded that anti-vax group, America's Frontline Doctors, to 60 days in prison for illegally entering the Capitol during the January 6th attack. The judge also ordered Gold, whose group has spread debunked claims about COVID-19, to pay a fine of $9,500. Doesn't seem like much, but that was the biggest at that point for nearly 200 rioters already sentenced. America's Frontline Doctors has done fundraising, claiming that Gold was being persecuted for giving a speech before the riot. Well, the judge, Cooper, told Gold during the sentencing, quote, "The only reason you're here is where and when and how you chose to express your views."
But that group, Frontline Doctors, that's where Florida governor, moron death sentence, plucked a quack to be our next Surgeon General. I'm not kidding. The so-called doctor's name is Joseph Latipo. And no surprise, Florida is now the only state in the nation that did not order any COVID-19 vaccines for kids 5 and under. People are already planning Disney and other vacations to Florida, but Florida is now your number one destination if you want to catch COVID. With barely any more testing done anymore except for home tests, Florida has reported 3 times as many cases as any other state. Thursday alone, Florida also leads in hospitalizations and deaths per day. So my advice, stay away. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.